Dark Side of the Radio, Where All the Good Songs Have Gone. We would like to welcome to the show one of my favorite artists. He's a great, great guitarist and maybe an even better singer. And he's got maybe one of the coolest hairstyles in rock and roll, Mr. Doyle Bramhall II. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we really appreciate you being here. We're big fans, and we got a lot of listeners who are, of course, into your music. So it's an honor to have you here.
Great, thank you.
So what have you been working on recently? I think I was told you were doing some stuff with B.B. King. Is that correct?
Yeah, I just finished a record with B.B. King, and that came about through a producer named Simon Climie, who produced the Writing with the King record with Eric Clapton, B.B. King.
Mm-hmm.
And Simon really liked the way that the album turned out, and he wanted to use the same players that were on that record. So it was pretty much the same players, except for instead of Steve Gadd, it was Abe Laborio Jr. on drums and myself. And I was the only other guitar player other than BB on that record. And we just finished it about three or four weeks ago. And just had a pretty amazing experience in the studio with BB. He was making a record. He's making a ballads record. And it's a record that he's wanted to do for 50 years. So he handpicked all the songs he's wanted to do. And there were songs ranging from Nat King Cole to Willie Nelson song to old BB songs they had cut in the '50s, and it was a pretty great experience.
That sounds pretty interesting. When do you think that's going to come out?
I think it's supposed to come out in March.
Cool. So it's a BB solo record, and you played. Did you play on the whole thing?
Yeah, I was the guitar player on the whole record.
Wow, that's
me
really
and BB.
Cool. Really cool.
So I was the second guitar player and guitar tuner for Lucille.
Well, that has to be very cool working with BB. When's the first time you did meet BB King and get to working with him?
Well, I worked with BB on Writing with the King, which was his collaboration with Eric Clapton, and that was about 3 years ago, I guess in 2000 or 2001,
mm-hmm.
I don't remember when, but that's when I met BB for the first time, and Eric covered two of my songs off the Jelly Cream record, and I ended up going down there to play on those two songs, and Clapton liked what I did, so he just kept me on for the whole project.
Cool. Talk a little bit about, we're going to switch topics here. We'll go back to when you were working with Roger Waters. As I said, you know, we're Dark Side of the Radio. We're big fans of Pink Floyd, obviously. And the first time that I saw you was in Nashville with Roger, and just really impressed, and watching the DVD in the flesh. I was just really impressed by how you handled Gilmour's vocals and also his guitar parts, and I think that you actually, especially Comfortably Numb, was a lot better than what Gilmour had done on Pulse and the other live records that the Pink Floyd put out.
Right.
So I mean, how was that? Working with Roger, I know that I've read some interviews, where you talked about that, but how did that all come about to where you even, got a shot to do that?
That came about through a producer named Patrick Leonard, who produced Amused to Death. That was Roger's last solo record.
Mm-hmm.
And Patrick Leonard, I guess they were looking for somebody to sing the David Gilmour parts on some of the songs and also play guitar in the band. And Patrick had heard my first record, and he thought that my voice and guitar playing would be perfect fit for Roger. And he called me up and asked me to make a demo of Comfortable Perfectly Numb and Money, and to send it to Roger. And at first I was a little skeptical because I didn't want to make a demo of Money just because it's such an in-depth song and there's so many parts and so much music to it that, you know, it's a huge production on that song.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Comfortably Numb is more of a concise song.
Right.
And I thought that was sort of doable for me, so I opted to make the demo of Comfortably Numb and just went in the studio and used their version of the song, but basically took the track out of phase so I could sing over it, and it would drop the lead vocal and lead guitar out of it. So I ended up basically doing karaoke to that version of Comfortably Numb, the Pink Floyd version, and sent it in, and Roger hired me the next day after he heard it. He was like, hire that guy. And it was pretty much that simple. He just liked what I did. So, going into that project, it was a lot different for me because, you know, it was much more choreographed than stuff that I had done in the past. You know, I'd grown up being a blues player and not having been real accustomed to working out a quote-unquote show. So it was a really interesting thing for me because it was almost like playing a part in a play.
Right.
Or, you know, being an actor in a play where, you know, I was one of the key pieces to that, but it was, you know, definitely a show that had a lot of different players, and sort of all bringing it together. And Roger's great at doing that. He's great at being a band leader and a conductor and a arranger and a, you know, a visionary person. He definitely has a concept of what he wants all the time. So, you know, it was pretty easy in that respect because he has such focus and vision that he knows how to delegate parts and different things to different musicians. It made our job a lot easier, you know, when somebody is that smart about his music.
Right, right. I know that you were working, I don't know exactly all the details, but I know that when you were working, you were on the road with Eric Clapton, I think, and when Roger and the gang went out worldwide to do their tour, you didn't make that trip, did you? Was it because you were with you were opening for Eric or something like that?
No, at the time I didn't want to go out because I had a couple different things. One was I had a newborn baby that I really didn't want to miss the experience of raising her in the first couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have an 8-year-old son that I didn't have the opportunity to be with him in the first couple of years of his life. So it's something I really wanted to experience, and I have, you know, a family, and I didn't really want to be away from them for 6 months. And another thing is that I was really intent on building a fan base of my own and getting my record sorted out. I mean, it's gone by pretty slowly, and nothing ever works out the way you think it will. But, you know, I still think, you know, I made the right choice. But I'm not saying that I wouldn't do that again if the opportunity came up. But just at the time, I didn't want to spend that much time away from my family.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the beginning when they talked about, and I don't want to focus the whole thing about you working with Roger, but of course it's an interesting topic. You know, when they say Roger's working on a solo record and that you in the beginning were working with him on that, so, like, are you not working with him anymore on that, or how's that working?
I don't really know. I mean, Roger has been working on the new record for about 2.5 years. years, and I started the process with him in the Bahamas, and then we had about a 8 or 9 month or a year layoff, and then he brought us back in the studio in London, and we started working on that record again, and we cut 5 more songs for that record. But I don't know. I mean, Roger takes a long time to make records. at least the last couple. And I think that, you know, he's a guy that's very he has a very thoughtful process about the whole recording process. What was the word I was looking for? Process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think what he's doing is he's getting as many songs together, and I think he likes to put a higher percentage of great songs on his records, and in order to do that, you have to live with songs for quite a while to see if they actually are as great as your first feeling was for those songs. So, I haven't gotten a call yet, but I think that, you know, if he does call, I would definitely work on his record.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always thought that even on In the Flesh, I mean, it's a really it's a really good, solid live record. And in some parts, it doesn't even sound live, really. You know,
right.
It's just a really, really good production, I guess. And but I always thought that it could have been better if I thought you should have sang a little bit more. And a lot of people on the web, and I guess a lot of Floyd fans and Roger fans tend to think that, you know, it would be cool if Roger used you on his solo record, sort of sharing some vocals on some songs.
Right.
Do you think, did that happen?
I think that it just all depends. I mean, it's really up to whatever Roger thinks is good for the song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's opposed to doing that. Having me sing, because we recorded a song that he recorded in 1967 or 68 that I think Marianne Faithfull recorded a version of this song that Roger wrote, and we re-recorded it in the studio, and he wanted me to sing it, and I ended up singing it. But I don't know if it really fits in with what he's doing at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was sort of like almost a country and western type vocal on top of you know, the chord changes that he had. So you know, I don't know if that fits in, but yeah, I mean, if the song is great and he thinks that he hears my voice on it, I think he would definitely use that. It just depends. It really depends on the song.
Yeah, because I mean, I like I think Roger his voice even now is really good. You know,
yeah, I think Roger's amazing. I mean, I don't think he's ever gotten credit for being a singer, but, you know, he has one of those voices like a Bob Dylan or a Neil Young that's...
oh, yeah, totally, totally.
You know, that's just so identifiable, and you can connect with it. Like, he's emotionally connected to his lyrics and his song so much that all the fans that hear the stuff can't help but connect with it. So if you have that kind of connection, that's gonna be the most powerful effect. You know, even more than being like, you know, some great riff guy, you know, acrobatic singer that can do everything. If you're not emotionally connected to this stuff, then it, you know, it's sort of pointless. Like, it's like fast guitar playing, really, really fast guitar playing, you know. I've only heard a few people that are really connected to what they're doing, and everything else other than that is just scales.
Right. Yeah, because a lot of people find it hard to believe, but I prefer Roger's vocals over Gilmore's, and people are like, you know, well, Gilmore's the one with the really good voice, and I'm like, no. I mean, there's just something about Roger's voice that, you know, I really like that. And I like the way he sounds. So, yeah, I really think he's got a great voice even today.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about some early influences in your life. You know, you're obviously a great guitar player. Talk about when you first started playing guitar, and who made you actually want to pick up the guitar or sing or you know, just play music. Who was that one artist, do you think, that?
I don't think it was really just one artist. I think because I was surrounded by such great guitar players in the early formative part of my childhood, it sort of all rubbed off on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was around Stevie Vaughan and Jimmy Vaughan and a lot of the great Texas musicians at the time, and I would go to clubs and with my dad and listen to Freddie King and watch Freddie King and Lightnin Hopkins and Albert Collins and, you know, a lot of the great Texas musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it was so innately in my blood that that, you know, it really became a part of my DNA, a blues guitar player.
Yeah.
Playing. And but, you know, later on, you know, I was a real blues purist for a long time, and until I turned 17, I had to start singing because we couldn't find a singer that could sing the songs that we wanted to do, because there weren't a lot of young 17-year-olds that were into blues at the time in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Or late 80s, you know. I think there were more people into Oingo Boingo than Albert King.
Yeah.
And so really just out of convenience I started singing, but when I did, I think all these other influences that I've been listening to for so long, like the Beatles and Stevie Wonder and Sly Stone and Donny Hathaway, they really affected me on a songwriting level, and especially with my vocals, I wanted to go for something different than just being a blues artist.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at that time I got hired to play with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and you know, I was definitely a purist for a long time when I was in that band, and then when I got out, I sort of wanted to break out and be a rock artist, just because that was the kind of song, those are the kind of songs that I was writing, were more rock type songs.
So when you talked about your dad, and I always, you know, you search the web and you type in Doyle Bramhall, even two, and you get like, you know, you get really confused.
Yeah.
But I like recently, just trying to find, you know, more information about you, I did find out a little bit more about your dad, and it seems that he's fixing to come out with a new record or something.
Yeah.
That's cool. See, I knew that your dad, you know, had worked with Stevie Ray Vaughan and wrote some songs and that kind of thing, but I'm just starting to sort of, you know, find out a little bit more about him through your work, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely Sanford and Son experience. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason I'm into music is my dad. He surrounded, I mean, I was around in the early 70s, and we used to live in a band house, and it was basically just a bunch of hippies that were listening to blues at the time, and Jimmy Vaughan and Stevie, and a couple of my uncle and my cousins, and it was basically the Bramhalls and the Vaughns living in the same house for a couple of years, so I was sort of surrounded by great guitar players, and not really realizing it, you know, because it was sort of the norm for me to be around those kind of guitar players and those kind of musicians, so that's all I grew up knowing. So when people asked me about it, you know, I didn't realize that all that was going down, and I was in the presence of, you know, some of the best guitar players ever.
Right, so to you that was just like, just normal.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing. Let's talk a little bit about shifting topics here once again, to your Welcome record. Now, I wasn't really familiar with anything you had done previously to Welcome, but I found that you had a record called, was it called Jelly Cream?
Yeah.
Okay. And how many records did you have before Welcome? Solo record.
I have three total. I had two before Welcome.
Okay.
My first record was just self-titled, Dora Bramhall II, and it was produced by Wendy and Lisa. And the next record that I made was a record that I made with Chad Blake, producer, engineer. And then the Welcome record I made with Ben Mott-Tinch from Tom Petty's band, the keyboard player. And
oh, wow, cool. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. And Jim Scott, he's a great engineer and producer.
So it seems that I've heard people discuss that Welcome was a little bit different than what you had done in the past. Is that true or is that not true?
Well, it was different than my other solo records, but it wasn't as different from like what I was doing in the Archangels.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Archangels, we were definitely a blues-influenced rock band from the South, so I think that on the last record, on Welcome, I just wanted to make a straight-up rock record,
mm-hmm.
And I wanted to showcase my guitar playing and singing, as well as songwriting, and I think on the first record, I was sort of getting away from the guitar just because I didn't want to be known as just sort of some guitar hero from Texas, and so I focused more on just vocals and the songwriting aspect of it. So I think, you know, it's sort of the whole evolution process has been, you know, pushing away the thing that got me to where, you know, that people knew of me because of my guitar playing, and sort of pushing that away and saying, well, I really want people to respect me for songs and my voice as well. So in the process of doing that, I sort of pushed my guitar playing away, and on Welcome, I wanted to bring that back in, and hopefully on the next record, I will have found the great missing combination between, you know, guitar playing, singing, and songwriting, and have the balance there.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of blues players are a lot of people who are known mainly for their guitar playing. It seems like when they do make maybe their first solo record, or eventually, you know, get around to making a couple, they eventually want to, it seems, stray away from just, you know, being recognized as just a, you know, a really good, great guitar god or whatever. So is that kind of the way, you know, why do you think that is? That, you know, why do you think that, you know, yourself and others, you know, I know Mark Ford, a really great guitar player with the Black Crowes, eventually went out and made a solo record, and a lot of people expected it to be just like this guitar, you know, rocking type record, you know, just strictly a blues record, but it wasn't that at all. He sang a lot on it. So why do you think that happens sometimes?
Well, I think with a lot of really musical people, if you're a songwriter and a guitar player, you want to do something different every time. You don't want to keep just churning out the same crap all the time, because it does nothing for you. You know, if I want to make my new record sound just like I did on my last record, then how am I evolving and how am I changing and what am I, you know, when you listen to the Beatles, if you listen to their first record and their last record, how far apart musically those records were, or even the Stones, you know, if you listen to their first record, they were making blues records in the beginning, and, you know, they're still making records that sound nothing like what they sounded like in the beginning, and I think that's just great songwriters and great musicians want to keep evolving and want to do something different every time. There was a time in the 60s and 70s when you could do that and it was acceptable and there wasn't such a huge gap between genres. And, you know, I think that's just the difference between really musical people. There are some people that are content with just making guitar records, you know, if they're guitar players, and they just want to showcase the guitar. But I don't think that in the end, 100 or 200 years from now, that people are going to be remembered, musicians or songwriters are going to be remembered if they don't have great songs. And I think the reason Hendrix is remembered as such a great guitar player is because the songs and the melodies that he came over the chord changes and his lyrics, he was really striving to be something different and not be content with anything that he was doing, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the key, just to keep pushing and striving to be better than you think you could ever be.
And it's just a matter of being creative, too, I mean, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and when you're being creative, you can't really help. You know, if you open that creative side of yourself and you're sort of just this open vessel,
right.
you don't really, you have no control over what kind of songs you're writing at the time, unless you're like a formulaic songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I mean, if you're really a creative artist, you're just gonna do whatever comes out of you.
Right.
And at the time, I don't think any artist really cares. Like, oh, is this gonna be pop enough for the top 40 radio, or is this gonna be rocking enough for rock or edgy enough? You know, I don't think great artists really think about that. I mean, they have to think about it because you have to survive. But I think that when artists start letting that get in the way of their songwriting, then it becomes more about editing your art.
And it becomes not so good after that.
No, then, you know, and I think that you become less connected with something that you have to edit.
Yeah. Something that I found interesting was, and, you know, cool at the same time, I'm not really big on FM radio these days. And I'd like to see more artists like yourself get played on mainstream radio, but it's really, you know, it's mainstream rock radio has gotten out of hand, obviously.
Yeah, right.
But I thought it was pretty cool as I was listening to a pretty big mainstream radio station locally when Welcome was just getting pretty big, and they played Green Light Girl pretty often, and I thought that was pretty cool that, you know, there wasn't much of that type of music that they were playing, but if they did play that sort of style of music, they were playing more of the classic artists.
Right.
So I thought that was pretty cool that, you know, there's not too many newer artists that get played very often on mainstream radio. Did you get that response from Green Light Girl, the single, or, you know, was it placed on a lot of radio stations? It seemed like I heard a lot of it.
Well, I think that's the key word, placed. It was placed on a lot of radio stations, but I don't think it got the response that the record label was looking for, so they immediately pulled the plug on the whole project. But, you know, there's just a real problem with the way a lot of radio stations are just geared to sell product. And I think that you know, if it just didn't work out because you know, it, with Green Light Girl, it was doing really well on certain stations.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they did some kind of review of the song, and I can't even remember what it's called, but it's, you know,
it wasn't like that survey thing, was it?
Huh?
I know they do those surveys. It wasn't something like
that. Yeah,
it was
one of those test market surveys they do, and they put it out there, and it didn't get a great response from fans. But I think the only reason it didn't get a great response was because they didn't actually play it enough for people to identify. 100 times before they can actually test market the song.
Yeah, totally.
And they did it, I think, after 90.
Right.
And, I mean, so they're sort of setting it up to fail. And then the record company heard back that it didn't test so well, and then they pulled the plug on it. You know, but there are other songs out there, like, for instance, that Lenny Kravitz song, Fly Away, bombed at radio. And then it did really well on in a commercial in London and blew up, and then everybody picked it up, and it was a huge hit. But the first time around, it completely bombed.
Right.
So I just think there are definitely ways to if it's a really good song, to make it happen. But
yeah.
You know, are our record companies really willing to risk their investments all that much by getting behind something they don't think they can get a huge return on?
Yeah,
it's just sad that, you know, I'm even having this conversation because, you know, it's just bullshit that it's all not, you know, 99% business and 1% music.
Yeah, totally. It seems like radio these days and these record companies, it's like they don't even know how to promote anything good. You know, they want to promote stuff like, you know, Nickelback or something, and you know, some of these mainstream acts, but you know, the thing with a lot of mainstream radio is that it all sounds the same. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, Led Zeppelin didn't sound like Pink Floyd, and they didn't sound like the Grateful Dead, and everything these days, it just, everything on the radio, everything on TV, don't you just think it's not creative at all, and it doesn't, you know, it just sounds the same?
It's just formula. It's formulaic songwriting, and it's just rehashing, because if they have a hit song by some by a band out there, and it's called rock, but that rock is just, you know, basically like, you know, what you were saying, whatever that band you, what was that band you just said?
Nickelback, yeah.
Nickelback, you know, and they have a huge hit with it, and they make $10 million off this huge record that they had with that band. Now the process is just trying to duplicate that and put a different face on it, and hopefully, like, oh, well, that's the new in thing. So everything's so trendy now. You get into these little trends, as opposed to, you know, listening to great bands. Like, I mean, Radiohead is one of those bands that is making records the way they want to, and just making their music and putting it out and having success with it. But, you know, it's really hard because, you know, I mean, they did have some hits on radio that sort of allowed them to make their music and make the records they wanted to make. But, you know, it's too hard because, you know, they want Christina Aguilera out there to make 10 or 20 million for them.
Yeah.
So they're not going to mess around with somebody that sells 200 to 500,000 copies. That's nothing to them.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think that the business, especially, you know, radio and I guess just the music business in general, do you think that it's going to change? Or do you, I mean, it seems like it has to change eventually. I mean,
oh, it is changing, definitely. It's in the middle of changing, and I think that right now it's at a point to where it's changing, but it doesn't really know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
The music business and music, it's just in this sort of state of limbo right now, where it wants to turn, but it has no direction, and nobody knows where it's going. And what's happening is the fans are basically trying to get back the power, you know, and the artists are trying to get back the power, but you have these that force going against this huge corporate force of record labels and you know, the certain radio stations that are tied into other corporate you know, businesses or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
And I think those forces are colliding right now, and it's just sort of like waiting for the planets to be formed after the, you know.
Yeah, because
after
mean,
the Big Bang, we're in the Big Bang again.
Yeah, because but I mean, you know, there's still that, there is that audience, you know, that audience that is sort of connected to where, you know, they like Government Mule, they like, you know, they like you, they like a lot of jam bands, you know, there is that scene, you know, but it's just, it's not as big, you know, it's hard to overcome, you know, all the corporate stuff, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are wanting to feel and think again in music. You know, there was a time up until, you know, some point probably in the 80s where it shifted and people went, you know, I just want everything to be light now. And I don't want to have to think about it. So if a tune comes on the radio, I don't want to have to think. I just want it to be really light and catchy and hooky and I can sing along with it and I don't have to think. And, you know, it's not really an emotional connection to music in that way, and the people that want to see that are going out to see bands that the musicianship is just really high, you know, still, and like, you know, Ben Harper or Government Mule or, you know, the bands that you named are bands that are playing, just playing music, and there are fans out there, but I just don't, you know, I don't think that really anybody needs to sell 10 million records. Like, it's just ridiculous. That's not music, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there was the occasional back, you know, in the 70s where Stevie Wonder would sell, you know, 4 million copies or whatever of his record, and that was like a huge deal, but it was an amazing task that, you know, that he had.
Yeah.
And now it's just, you know, people are wanting to go back out and see real music again, and hopefully it'll change. I think that, you know, internet is helping that along, but it just, you know, I hope the process sort of goes by a little quicker for me, just because I'm sort of caught up in this, like, you know, ambiguous place that, you know, don't know where the hell I am.
Right. I mean, I know Green Light Girl could have done really well on the radio, because we played it, you know, for a very long time. But I mean, when we first started playing, I remember getting listeners who just emailed us just the first time hearing it, just asking, "Who is this? Where can we get it? You know, this is just really an incredible tune, and we haven't heard anything, you know, about this person or anything." And I was like, "Yeah, it's Doyle Bramall II. Go check it out." You know, so there's definitely a lot of people who, from just listening to that song for the first time, really did, you know, they really dig it. I mean, they really liked it a whole lot.
Right.
So, I mean, I know it could have done well, you know, and I thought it done pretty good to get, you know, on mainstream radio, and I know it was in a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because I was watching a movie a couple months ago, and it came on. I was like, hey, that's pretty cool. But it seems like you
too
got...
Too little, too late, man.
What?
Too little, too late.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, it seems that, you know, you've got to take other outlets even sometimes, since radio won't play it, you know. You know, a lot of people are now putting their songs on commercials and movies,
yeah.
And sometimes I don't agree with it, but if you really begin to think about it, if radio's not going to play it, you got to
get
it.
Well, yeah, if record companies aren't going to help you out and are going to pull the plug if it doesn't do well the first time, then you have to do something like that, because it's the only way of getting it to a mass audience enough to where, you know, it sort of starts some kind of buzz or fire, you know.
So what is going on with you and your record company right now? What's that situation
like? I don't
like?
Have a record company. I've been label-less for a year and a half.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. I didn't get any material on you, and there's no website anymore for you, so I didn't know about that. So you were, wasn't you with like RCA or something?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're now independent then?
I guess you could call it that, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of people going independent these days and selling records and everything, but I didn't know that. So when you make another record, Are you going to put it out on like an independent label, or are you going to try to get another big time record label to put it out? Or have you even thought about it?
Yeah, no, I've thought about it every day of my life. But, I mean, it's a hard choice because, you know, there's a tendency, especially for somebody like me who's, I've been signed and I've, to major labels since I was 18. So there's always a part of me that wants that big machine working for me. But, you know, I made three records for three major labels and it's all played out the same. Where, you know, at some point after the first single comes out, and if it doesn't do well, then they pull the plug on it, they don't put anything else out. And it's always them putting out a song that is not the song that you originally got signed for, that they fell in love with you for, and, you know, it's the song that you believe in the most, and everybody believes in it, but then at the last second they go, well, we can't put that out because, you know, we don't know where to go with that, we'll just put out the rock song. And, you know, it just doesn't give it any chance to work itself out, you know. And, I don't know, I mean, because really you get a shot, and that shot is about 3 weeks long after your record comes out, literally.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know any of the, you know, I didn't know any of that, but.
Yeah, you get 3 weeks. They give you 3 weeks to see how it's doing. And if it's not taking off and you don't have a president of a company or somebody high up in the hierarchy that's really behind you that says, you know, we're going to keep doing this, keep pushing it. Like, you know, Sheryl Crow, for instance, they worked, I think, four songs. Her first song, which didn't do anything, and then she put out another song that did, you know, okay, and then Leaving Las Vegas was the third single, I think, and that did, you know, a bit better. But it wasn't until the last single that the president of the company was really behind her and said, we're going to stick with it. A year later, after her record came out, they put out her fourth single, and she was touring, and it caught on, and then that started her whole career. But, you know, you don't have that opportunity anymore because you don't have people that are that hands-on, that are that high up in companies anymore.
Right.
So,
So you're saying with you it was Green Light Girl, and then that was your only shot then? You know,
I mean, that wasn't the first song that... I mean, that was the first song we were going to go with, but we were planning on putting out a second single, and that single was probably going to be a song called So You Want It to Rain.
That's my favorite one off the record.
That's cool. But at the time when we were supposed to release it, at the last second we got a call from the president of the company, Jack Roedner, and he said, nope, not going to happen. Let's talk about making your next record. I was thinking, well, we spent all this time on the road. We've been up with Eric Clapton for 9 months. What could be a better opportunity for any band to open up on a tour like that, and you guys haven't done anything, you haven't pushed it, and now you're saying we're going to make the next record when we just started this whole process. Why would I make another record if you're going to do the same thing to that record?
Right.
So, you know, I thought that Rain, So You Want It to Rain, was a song that would probably be able to cross over into different genres and not just sort of the classic rock format that was Green Light was going to. And I thought it, you know, definitely showcased my voice and guitar playing, and it was a great rock song, but never got the chance to be heard.
So is that sort of where the relationship with RCA went bad, or?
Well, no, I mean, it was always a struggle. I mean, I had an A&R guy named Bruce Floor that was really behind it, but, you know, that was only, it was one person at a record company that was carrying all the weight of everything on his shoulders. There's no way one person can do it, you know. It has to be the whole company, and it's his job to get the whole company excited. And when you have people like the president of the company saying no all the time to everything that he comes up with, and he's, you know, Bruce Floor was a very ambitious person, and he wanted to get things done, and nothing was getting done because when it comes down to it, if the president of the company said, no, I don't believe in this artist, I don't get it, and I don't trust you with it, then there's not much one person can do. You have to have the machine.
Yeah. See, I was under the impression that, I mean, I just assumed that the record did really well, because, you know, I'd heard a lot about it, a lot of people telling me about it, a lot of people just seemed to be into it, so...
I think as far as, like, when people got a hold of the record, it was like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
And people responded to it like it was a classic record, but just didn't make it into a lot of people's hands, you know?
Like I talked about, I tried to go to the website that you used to have, and I think now you go to it and it pulls you up to, like, the artist TLC or something.
Yeah, that's another great marketing strategy on the record company's part, where they know people are going to go up to my website, so they won't give me that website.
Yeah, the domain name.
Yeah, they wouldn't give me that name. So, but they keep it, so anybody that goes on, they can at least plug TLC,
that's
one of their
terrible
BMG artists.
That's terrible.
That's just another sick way of doing business.
Oh, geez. So what's going on? Are you getting a website together? How's that?
Yeah, I'm putting together an official website.
Okay.
And I'm trying to get that out in the next couple months.
Cool. Do you have any idea what that will be, you know, what the address will be or anything?
I think it's going to be Doyle Bramhall 2nd, which is the number 2 ND.
Mm-hmm. .com then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people are still interested in what you're doing and everything. There's a lot of people who still comment on the songs we play from, you know, from Welcome and obviously the stuff from In the Flesh, so I'd like to see you put out another record. Hopefully that's going to happen. Are you writing songs or what's going on?
Yeah, I'm writing songs. I'm going back and forth, you know. It's hard not to have some kind of situational depression due to the industry right now, but, you know, I'm sort of struggling with that because I'm having to work so hard because basically, I am the only person that believes in me, and sometimes I sort of question that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't believe in myself, then the whole everything stops, and then I got to work my way back up and say, you know, I got to make this happen. But yeah, I can't really I have to do all the work and try and really figure out the best path that's going to get me to where I want to be, which is, you know, a place where I can have an audience out there that can get my records, and I can go on the road and survive and make records and play music.
Right. So you were opening for Eric Clapton there for a while. What was did you get some response from that? I mean, it seemed like a lot of people who caught those shows were pretty impressed.
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty much it was, you know, it was weird. We did really well in Europe and Japan and Europe, because I think that the fans in Europe are less about that sort of mass media driven artist that they have here. And they just didn't judge it. So, you know, if it was good, they were enjoying it. So we ended up selling 5,000 to 8,000 copies of the record in every country that we went to over there. And that's, you know, really good.
Right.
For not having much much press or much promotion behind it.
Right.
But, you know, I think at this point, you know, I'm just going to have to make the best record that I've ever made.
Yeah.
And hopefully get with whatever label. I don't know if it'll be an internet label or you know, the alternative labels or a boutique label, indie label. out, but so we can get my record out to as many people as possible, and then just go on the road and you know, try and get some kind of following. It's just really hard because record companies aren't giving tour support anymore for bands like myself, and it's really hard to even go out in a van and stay at Econo lodges. It just all adds up after a while.
Yeah.
And that becomes really expensive. So it's hard.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know.
Well, I know there's a couple of really good smaller labels that are pretty cool. I don't know if you've heard of Lost Highway.
Yeah, it is.
And that's a really, you know, they put out some really, they take some chances with,
right.
I think the Jayhawks are on that record label. And
I think they passed on my last record.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, see, I would think an artist like you would be perfect for a label like that.
Yeah, they were one of the first companies I called because I felt the same way as you. I thought they were putting out stuff that was, it was just about music. And, but, you know, we tried to get a hold of them and they just weren't interested in the record that we made.
Yeah. Because, you know, like, I think Johnny Cash is even on that label. That's pretty cool.
Right.
And I think the lead singer from, of course, we had him on the show, Chris Robinson, he went with an independent label called Redline Records, I think.
Yeah.
And that's a, I mean, that seems like that's a pretty good label. I think they're in with Best Buy. And so I think he's doing fairly well with that, but
right.
But yeah, I think you could if you could just get the music out there. That's what it's all about, you know.
Yeah, I mean, let us do the work because you know the best publicity and best promotion that we have is playing live, and people buy records when we play live, and that showed when we played with Eric Clapton. We would play when we had days off. We would play in clubs and the markets that we were with Clapton, and whenever we played, you know, with Clapton, we would sell like 20 CDs at the venue for Clapton, 20 to 30 CDs, and then we would play a club show and sell like 500 to 1,000 copies in the next couple of days after we had been there at the club. So I think that's what it just shows, that you know, if you get us out there on the road, we're going to build it, you know.
Yeah, totally. Because anytime, like I haven't seen you perform live besides with Roger, but I would think in a live setting, you would be even, you know, even better than in the studio, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I've got the, I think it's a performance from Austin City Limits, I think.
Yeah.
And we've got some tracks on from that, and it sounds really, really good. Some smoking guitar.
Yeah, that was even before I had the band that I do now.
Oh yeah?
That was the very beginning when Wendy and Lisa were still involved and Chris Bruce, who turned out to be the bass player, was playing guitar on a couple of songs, and that was the first gig that the new drummer played with us. So that's, you know, that's before we sort of came up with the Smokestack sound that we have now.
Yeah. So are you playing at, like, when's the last live date that you played with Smokestack?
We just played Austin about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago.
Okay, cool. So you're still playing shows and that kind of thing, then?
Yeah, I mean, they're just sort of one-offs, but hopefully, you know, we're going to record some new songs, start shopping for a deal, and get out there and start playing. I mean, at least build up some a fan base, at least in regional places like, you know, Southern California or just California and Texas, and we do really well in Detroit and Toronto and Boston and places like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm near Nashville. It seems like you got a band like yours would do really well there too. A lot of great bands come through Nashville, and it's, you know, Music City.
Yeah.
So, let's switch topics here. We got a lot of questions for you about, and I usually ask a lot of people this when they're on the show. First, what records are you into these days? Like, what's in your CD player or, you know, record player?
The only record that I've really liked, like in the last year, my favorite record was Queens of the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
The new release.
Mm-hmm. It's a good record.
That was, in my opinion, the hardest, most rocking. With, you know, there was something very punk rock about it, and it was just rocking. And I think it blew away every joke band out there.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there are a lot of people out there that thought they were hard, but when this record came out, it just basically said, you know what, fuck everybody, we're bad.
Right. Right. What are some of the most another question about records? What are some of the most important records in your life? As far as, you know, if you had to go off to an island, could only take a couple of records, which ones would you take? That's always a hard question too.
Well, I would probably say that I would have to definitely take the Donnie Hathaway live records. Stevie Wonder, Beatles, Sly Stone. I mean, those are the records I always like get off on the most.
Yeah, Sly and the Family Stone, they're great.
Yeah,
great. A lot of comparisons to Jimi Hendrix for you.
Right.
How does that make you feel?
Well, you know, a part of me likes that just because I'm really into tones,
mm-hmm.
guitar tones, and I was always such a huge fan. I've always been a huge fan of Hendrix's, but I think I don't want to be remembered as another guy that sounded like Hendrix, because there are too many of those Hendrix casualties out there. And so at this point, I'm really trying to break from that. Because I don't want to sound like anybody, you know. I don't mind having influences, but I don't think that anybody could tell that Hendrix was really influenced by Buddy Guy,
right.
or Earl King, or Albert King, you know, because he made it his own thing. You know, he took from great artists, great guitar players, but he just made it his own, so it sounded like him. And I think that's sort of the key. So I definitely don't want to try and make records anymore that sound anything like anybody.
You just want to make them sound like Doyle Bramhall II.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of stuff on Welcome was pretty original sounding. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, but, you know, at first listen, people that don't know much about music could sit there and say, oh, he's just trying to sound like Hendrix. And I think that those are the people that aren't really trying that hard. You know, they're not really listening that intently to the music. They're just getting a first impression by it and go, oh, that sort of sounds like Hendrix, or that sort of sounds like Stevie Ray Vaughan. But I think, you know, that's the thing about writing great songs, because the songs are the key to your own personality. And I think if the songs are really great, then your personality will shine through all of that.
Yeah, I think, of course, I'm just a big fan of that Welcome disc. And I originally, when you first hear it, like you say, you sort of think, well, yeah, this is definitely influenced by certain artists. But then, I mean, it sort of comes into its own, I guess, after
right.
a while. You know, when you really get into listening to it and you really do sit down and focus on the music, you know. It's pretty original, you know. It's got an original sound to it.
Right. Well, it's as original as, like, an early Rolling Stones record where they were doing covers of Howl and Wolf songs or Slim Harpo. And nobody even realizes that, like, if you listen to the Slim Harpo versions of the songs that the Stones covered, they did the exact version. They did the exact production, but because it came out in 1960 something, as opposed, you know, whatever, and it was a bunch of English kids playing that way, it was like, oh, this is so new and it's so blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But they didn't even know that they completely did the song, exactly like Sam Harpo.
Right.
I mean, everything, down to the percussion, everything was exactly the same. And they used the same delay on the vocal, but, you know, because it was the Stones, they were coming up with the most innovative thing.
Right.
But, you know, that's the thing about great artists. They know where to steal from and how to do it, you know.
Yeah, Zeppelin kind of did that too early on.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, Zeppelin just had such a weird take on blues that it just didn't sound like, you know, they thought they were playing blues early on, but their take on it was so weird that it didn't sound anything like what they thought it sounded like, you know?
Right.
And plus, you can't really go wrong if you have a band like, you know, John Bonham on drums. You can't really go wrong if you have a drummer like that.
Right, right. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up here. I don't want to take any more of your time, but we really appreciated it, and it's been an honor to talk with you, and we just thank you for being here, and hopefully you can get a website up and definitely a record out, and we'll definitely promote anything that you put out in the future.
Cool. Well, I'll see you on the dark side.
Yeah, man. We appreciate it, and hope to have you back sometime in the future.
Doyle All right,
Bramhall.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Doyle Bramhall II. Stick around, we're going to play some music from Doyle, a couple in a row from him. So stick around, Dark Side of the Radio, where all the good songs have gone.